Pleasant evening to you once again. I am Gregston Seeley. It's Sunday evening. That's time for another edition of the Better Health Radio Show. And on deck this evening, we've got for you. You thought you've missed her for quite some time, but we've brought her back. She's here again, Dr. Kia Lewis. So welcome back, Dr. Kia Lewis. The show is all yours.
Good evening, Gregson. How are you?
I'm not too bad at all. Hold on, something's interfering with us in here somewhere. Let me see if I can find it. Ah, I think that's it. Oh, try it again. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was saying good evening. I was asking how you are.
Yeah, I'm not too bad. Apart from
just to say it's a...
Go ahead.
No, I'm just saying it's just a wonderful privilege to be back with you. Like you said, it's been a while. And I want to send a warm welcome to our listeners from cold, rainy London. I'm connecting with you halfway around the world, but it's such a privilege, like I said, to be able to do this again, to be able to connect with you in Barbados, and to welcome you to another Better Health Radio Show, a show which is aimed at raising public awareness of common health issues that affect us all. As usual, we are very much looking forward to an engaging and interactive session, and I want to take the opportunity to remind you that you can contact us with your questions or comments either by calling in at 434-1790, that's 434-1790, or you can send your WhatsApp messages if you're a bit radio shy to 266-4862. That's 266-4862. Now, I have one request of you, Gregston.
Mm-hmm.
Are you willing?
If I'm able, sure.
Yeah. I was wondering if you could package some sunshine and some heat in a bottle or something and send it to me in London.
Well, my dear, I
could send you an address.
I hate to disappoint you, but you mentioned cold and rainy weather just now. I'm telling you, we are mirroring your atmospheric conditions because we're having some weather down here, raining as well. So I don't know how we can help you. Let's hope that will change in a couple of days.
Oh dear, I was hearing that.
Yep.
Maybe in a couple of days, Frank. So at least you can send me some warmth, if not the rain, if not the sun. You can send me some warmth. Yeah.
I hope the better for you.
All right. Yes, appreciate it. So this evening, we're really excited to have on board a special guest. We know, we try to get people who are well-versed in the topic, the cream of the crop for you, and this evening is no exception. I'm happy to welcome Dr. Diane Brathwaite to the show. Dr. Brathwaite, you are no stranger to the Better Health Program, but welcome again. It's great to have you.
Hi, Kia. Nice to see you. No problem at all. Is my audio quite clear?
Very.
Your audio is quite clear.
Very clear.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for having me.
Yes, excellent. So let me remind you a little bit about Dr. Brathwaite, or to introduce you to her for those who don't know her. Dr. Diane Brathwaite, she is the clinical director at the Maria Holder Diabetes Center for the Caribbean. She's studied an undergraduate medicine at the University of the West Indies and postgraduate internal medicine, diabetes, and endocrinology in the United Kingdom. She believes in empowering persons so they can take charge of their health and live their best life possible, physically and mentally. Welcome again, Dr. Brathwaite. And as you might have guessed from this introduction, we are going to be talking about something that we've talked about quite a bit, but we can never talk about this enough because it is something that is a topic that is so important to us here in Barbados, and that is diabetes. We know that this month we usually have Observation of Diabetes Day, and there's a lot of discussion surrounding it. And we always like to highlight awareness surrounding diabetes. And particularly in this year, we are looking at risk factors for diabetes and getting people to screen, increasing access to care, those types of things. So first off the bat, we always like to start with a good definition. Dr. Brathwaite, if you had to describe for us what diabetes is in a way that the average layman could understand, what would that description be?
Yeah, sure, no problem, Kia. So first of all, diabetes mellitus, so that is the proper or the full term for diabetes mellitus, is a basic what we call metabolic or medical condition, whereby the levels of the glucose in the blood are elevated beyond the normal range. Some people refer to glucose as sugar, so everybody knows of it as the sugar. And it happens because you either have the absence or the impaired function of a hormone that helps us to process and balance out the sugars in our body. And that hormone is called insulin. We can go jump very quickly into the main types. If you have an absolute absence of the insulin, you develop something called type 1 diabetes, and you have to actually replace it, the insulin, with insulin into your body to survive. If you don't have that insulin to survive, you'll actually get very sick and you can die. With type 2 diabetes, although the body is producing insulin, the insulin doesn't function effectively. So in essence, what happens, let's simplify this a bit more, when you eat a sugar or a carbohydrate or a starch, all of these things go into the stomach, they're digested. And when you're digested, all those three things, sugars, carbohydrates, starch, we use them interchangeably, they're broken down into sugars. They then get absorbed, and those sugars go into the blood system. When the body picks up, wait, there's too much sugar in my blood, the body then releases this hormone called insulin from an organ in the back of the abdomen. It's called the pancreas. And that insulin literally opens sugar channels throughout the whole body, in the muscle, in the brain, in the liver. And it makes these sugar channels almost like suck the sugar out of the blood and into these organs, where they can either be stored or they can be used for energy. So in essence, somebody with diabetes, type 2 diabetes, doesn't have more absolute sugar in their body. The real issue is with how they transport it, or that inability to transport it to be utilized and burned up for various reasons. There can be a number of issues that exist with type 2 diabetes, which is why it's so different between different people. But essentially, that is what diabetes is. I would just want to say very quickly, I referred to diabetes as a metabolic disorder, and one of the challenges with that is when you have too much sugar in your bloodstream, because remember, blood goes from all over the body, from your head right down to your toe, to your nerves, to your liver, to your eyes. Sugar goes everywhere. So when you have it in excess, it deposits in places in your body and then starts to cause damage, either by damaging the vessels that supply that organ with blood to survive, or because it does direct damage because it is in excess there. So it can affect a lot of organs in the body, and we call that term for being able to affect a lot of things, multisystemic. Okay, so I will just kind of sum it, round it off into that for you. And hopefully, everybody can get some kind of visual, hopefully, by the way it was explained.
Yeah, that was excellent. It was a mouthful, but it was very, very interesting. And I think you broke it down quite well so that the average person could understand what you're saying. I just wanted to go into the types of diabetes. You touched on that type 1 diabetes versus type 2 diabetes. And you kind of explained how those come about. But I wondered, who are we more likely to see type 1 diabetes in compared to somebody with type 2 diabetes? They're different in
Well,
ages.
yeah, so therefore, type 1 more commonly occurs in children, adolescents, and young adults, but it can also occur in older people as well. Okay, type 2 diabetes tends to occur more in adults, really, of any age, once you hit past the age of 20 and onwards and going onwards. But what we have an interesting trend, obviously, that we're observing nowadays is that we're seeing more type 2 diabetes in adolescents and younger children. Okay, so previously, like say maybe 40 years ago, people would say, oh, the type 1 has a child's diabetes and the type 2 is the adults. But we're seeing that both types are merging across the age groups now. And that in itself has various implications, because the majority of people who have diabetes are actually type 2. And a very small minority are one. But what it means is that if more and more adolescents are getting pre-diabetes, or their risk of diabetes, we're going to see a lot more people in young adulthood who have type 2 diabetes within the coming, years, decades, whatever is the case.
And that actually feeds right into my next question. We tend to discuss things here that are topical and very much prevalent. And so my question then would be, how common is type is, well, diabetes mellitus worldwide, and then certainly how common is it in Barbados?
Well, the prevalence varies a lot throughout the world, but realistically, the Caribbean, we have some of the higher rates in the world. Most of the Caribbean islands are sitting within probably close to, I would say, the top 10 countries, some of them. There are some places that have higher rates than us, but unfortunately, when you think about it, we're like, they always say we're a little dot in the ocean, we're a little dot in the ocean, but we're a big dot in the diabetes world in terms of how many people have it relative to the size of the population. So if we look at Barbados, for example, it depends on what statistics you're looking at, but ranges can be 14 to 17%. Some people say nearly one in five to make it easy for people to understand. And if you compare that like to temperate climates, there are other places where you're talking and developed nations, 9%, maybe 11% or so. So we definitely are going to be higher than, say, for example, the American population or the population in the United Kingdom, et cetera.
Yeah, and that's something that we really have to look at. I think what concerns me is when you talk about the fact that we're seeing an increase among persons, among adolescents, an increase in type 2 diabetes. And so that means that you rightly said that in years to come, we could see the amount of persons having diabetes increase. So that's something that's definitely concerning. And my question then would be, why are we seeing these trends? So that's a
So
very
the
specific question, but I guess the broader question is, what are the risk factors? So we can start there. What are the risk factors? And then we can zero back into why we're seeing these trends.
Okay, so the risk factors, and I'm going to put this at the top of the list, and I'm probably doing this a little bit purposefully. I would say a lot of the we have two types of risk factors. We have the risk factors that you can't change, and they call those non-modifiable risk factors, and the risk factors you can change, which are the modifiable risk factors. So let's go through the non-modifiable risk factors first. So these are the ones that you really can't change, do anything about. So number one, your race. Okay, so Afro-Caribbean, Asian descent, these are very high, they have very high kind of genetic risk, etc. Obvious, sorry, I'm just a bit tired from the long day. All right, so you have the race. If you have a family history of diabetes, so if your parents had it, auntie had it, uncle had it, etc., you might be prone to it. I'm not going to go through all of them, but then there's some of the things that are really driving diabetes right now are going to be things that are lifestyle mediated. So therefore, things like our diet, right, the lack of physical activity, and they actually call this lack of physical activity. They actually now calling it a big fancy word called sedentarism. I hope I said that right. And it means people have a very sedentary lifestyle. Okay. Also, if you think about things like hypertension, do you have hypertension? If you have hypertension, your risk of getting diabetes is higher. Do you have high cholesterol? If that is the case, your risk is higher. Do you work in an environment that could possibly be promoting diabetes? So, for example, there are some thoughts that some of the chemicals that are being used are contributing to diabetes, obviously. Do you smoke, right? We mentioned diet, lifestyle, but also are you overweight or is there what we call clinical maybe obesity, or do you have more central body fat kind of around the abdomen? So these are some of the common things. Of course, people, there's also new links to things like people who don't sleep very well, sleep apnea. Right, there are also new links to, believe it or not, menopause. So women, for example, when they go into their menopause, diabetes might rear its head because of hormonal changes. But that's something you can't change. You're going to go into menopause, right? But those are kind of some of the common things. Something else that you can't change that will flip onto the other side, non-modifiable, that would be, did your mommy have diabetes with you while, you were a baby inside the womb, right? So if your mommy had diabetes while she was pregnant or developed it during pregnancy, you also are more likely to get it. So the diabetes in the pregnancy, that is another term for a type of diabetes we didn't mention, but that's called gestational diabetes. So that's another type of diabetes.
Just to add, gestational diabetes also puts the mother at risk, yes?
Of course,
If
yeah,
I'm looking
gestational
at it
diabetes,
right.
mother at risk. There, when you get gestational diabetes, this means that you might be diagnosed as having diabetes, usually later on in the pregnancy. So what they'll call near the third term or the third trimester. Now, a portion, those women are actually going to remain diabetic. Some of the majority of them will actually go back to not being diabetic. But then down the road, the ones who go back to not being diabetic, they've actually shown it's more than 30%. Over half of them will become diabetic over the next couple of years. And it usually happens anywhere between 4 to 10 years after having that gestational diabetes. And it's really thought that that person basically had an underlying risk to becoming diabetic anyway. Being pregnant kind of pushed them over, and then it kind of just manifests afterwards. But, you know, the rate at which people convert from being gestational diabetic, I have no diabetes, then moving on to diabetes, is very, very variable, right? It can be anywhere, as I said, from 2 to 10 years. So you mentioned screening, and that's why I have one of the areas that I'm quite, I think, passionate about, and I try to remind people all the time, is that they must tell these mothers that they have to rescreen. And the reason that I say that is sometimes I get, like, we have quite a few younger ladies with a new diagnosis of diabetes come to us. And when we ask, we find out, well, they actually had gestational diabetes, but they didn't know for some reason. I don't know if the message didn't get through or it wasn't mentioned often, because, you know, sometimes you have to tell people things more than once, right? Yes. But it just pops up with them with really high blood sugars. But then you find out they had gestational diabetes and they weren't screening at all. And likewise, so many of those women seem unaware that their children also have to get screened, certainly by about age 11, 12 or so. Right. So that is something that I think like to push and like to share, because the thing about diabetes is you want to really try and pick it up before it is almost, established. I think we have a call coming through. Yeah,
we definitely have a caller. Sorry to interrupt you because you're making a very important point. We're going to jump right back to that. But I want to welcome our first caller for the evening. Good evening, caller. Welcome to Better Health.
Yes, hi. Great evening, Dr. Lewis. How are you?
I am well. How are you?
Oh, wonderful. That's great. Well, I love you for blessing me with your presence. Thank you that all my blessings come from you, because we bless a man can curse. Let me welcome you.
Yes, thank you so much for being here.
Yes, thank you very much. Let me welcome you back all the way from London. It's really a pleasure. I really was impressed by all of your feats. So talking about diabetes as well, and you were just mentioning the point. Sorry to interrupt you. I'm just asking a couple of questions and go. My first question has to do with diabetes and pregnancy. Can a woman who is pregnant, who has either type 1 or type 2, or more so type 1, would that mother transfer the diabetes to the fetus or to the child when it is born? That brings me to my second question. In terms of a mother who has diabetes insipidus, which we know is the pituitary gland's disorder that makes you more thirsty, if that mother as well is urinating, for instance, she's urinating a lot, can that child get diabetes insipidus as well, based on the fact of her symptoms and her change in obviously her pituitary gland when it performs, or her lack thereof? My penultimate question has to do with diabetes and children, which is that we know more so for the type 1. In terms of diabetes and the children that's coming through that COVID pandemic, where they were, as you would have mentioned, had sedentaryism, and they would have had the environmental factors such as not being able to go and play and not being able to be very active in terms of exercise, but then the crucial point of having the real bad food to eat, the ultra-processed and processed sugars, because obviously they wouldn't have been able to be around the school nutritional policy, which I have to thank you for championing, Dr. Lewis. So what were children, and why did that play a deal, a very bad role in the aspect of diabetes and when the children went through COVID? And my final question has to deal with the fact of, good evening to the good doctor, and thank Grayson for taking my call. Now, in terms of the urine excessive lack of sweetness in it, I'm sure there are tests for it. But what about the heat that we're now facing, or this particular acute crisis. I know you would have done a program with Dr. Latonya Arthur, Dr. Lewis, so I'm just asking about that. This excessive thirst and the symptom, which is a symptom of diabetes, really, both type 1 and type 2, and how would that be better diagnosed, or how can that be better screened for persons who are suffering from this heat thirst, but may have diabetes as well, in that case, for their diagnosis, treatment, and hopefully cure. Thank you very much. Have a nice evening. You've brought it into my soul. Showing off their growth.
Thank you so much, caller. So let me just say that we're going to be talking about diagnosis of diabetes a little further in the show. So if you hold on, you will get the answer to that question. But I am going to throw the other questions at Dr. Brathwaite now. So Dr. Brathwaite, the first question is whether diabetes can be passed on from mother to child, well, the baby, or mother to fetus, rather.
Yeah, so diabetes, it can't be it's not directly passed in that way. In other words, mommy won't give to birth to a baby who is suddenly diabetic. However, there is a genetic risk, and that genetic risk may raise its head several years down the road for the child. But of course, there are complications that can occur to the baby by virtue of the fact that mommy had diabetes. So for example, we'll see the baby may be born very large, might be prone to injuries at birth, might have issues with low blood sugars, but not being born directly with diabetes.
Then he asked about diabetes insipidus as well. Similar question.
Yeah, no, diabetes insipidus is not transmitted in that way to the fetus. And diabetes and insipidus and mellitus are not directly related either. Okay.
Yeah, two very different conditions. And then the other thing, the other question, I gather he was asking about, given the children were in lockdown during COVID, they weren't able to play, etc. I guess whether this increases their risk or how it affects their risk of developing diabetes. I don't know if that's what you gathered as well, but.
Yeah, that's fine. So it does increase risk. So first of all, I want to just point out, we're talking about diabetes, but there is a condition, it's called prediabetes. I don't like to distinguish between the two because to my mind personally, they are the same thing and they lie on a spectrum. So for the kids, what we saw definitely was that it was increasing, for some of them, the risk of the prediabetes. So they weren't necessarily just turning up diabetic. But in terms of being sedentary, etc., the challenge that we had, obviously, was that a lot of children put on weight. We saw that in a small study that Dr. St. John did at the Heart and Stroke Foundation. We've seen in all the international literature that childhood body weight basically went up during the pandemic. And it even happened with infants as well. There are some studies that looked at infants and show that babies actually put on more weight during the pandemic as well. So, of course, once you're putting on extra body fat, you're putting down fat in your liver and your pancreas, and that's going to increase the risk of your insulin not working properly down the road and of developing prediabetes or diabetes. Okay. In terms of talking about COVID, and this may not be directly on children, but COVID in itself can also unmask diabetes. So we had some cases whereby actually COVID was contributing to new cases of diabetes, and that's by virtue of being sick and having the viral illness in the body being under stress. So we did actually have a few cases like that we would have seen. And that's also been documented with COVID predisposing people to new onset of both type 1 and type 2 diabetes. I don't know if we have any statistics in Barbados looking at the number who had a new diagnosis of diabetes by virtue of COVID, but the argument can also be maybe they may be pre-diabetic and they didn't know, but COVID tipped them over into diabetes and they then became aware because the high blood sugars made them feel poorly. So all interesting and good questions brought up there.
Definitely. You mentioned obesity and diabetes, and you talked about central obesity. So is there a type of obesity that predisposes people to diabetes, and then what's the relationship between excess fat in the body and the development of diabetes and insulin resistance and then diabetes?
All right. So unfortunately, persons who have more what we call central body fat, so that means more body fat like around your abdomen, because you know sometimes you people see people who are very slim, but yet they may have like a big tummy or whatever. And the reality is that you may, yes, acquire it through your lifestyle, but there are some people who are genetically predisposed to have that distribution of body fat. Now, the fat that occurs around the abdomen is different kind of from the fat that you get like on the legs and maybe the hips and stuff like that. It's metabolically different and metabolically, it just has a different activity compared to the other fat on the body. So the thing about that is when you see somebody who has a lot of tummy fat, that is not only representing fat tissue sitting under the skin, but what that's telling you is that person probably has a higher proportion of body fat that's sitting inside their organs, in their abdomen, around their heart, more fat in their liver, more fat in their pancreas, more fat in the muscle cells, okay? So that central body fat is a reflection of something we call organ fat, or it's a reflection of the proportion of visceral fat. Now, when you have fat inside the pancreas, the liver, the muscle cells, that actually impairs the organs, the cells in that organ, they just do not respond to insulin as well. There's something about cells that are full of fat, they don't respond to insulin as well. So when the sugars go up, the body produces some insulin, and you know, it's like the organ is going like, not today. It has more fat. It's like, not today, insulin. I can't take you on right now. So it doesn't take up the sugar. And then the sugar levels go higher. And then you get the deposition of sugars in the different places. It's a vicious cycle. Because what happens is when the sugars are high, they're then changed into more fat in the body that then get put back down inside the same organs. So it's a big cycle of, okay, I have some fat, I'm insulin resistant, my fat is floating around. Well, I can't use your fat, so I'm going to change you into storage as more fat, and that fat then goes into the organs, causing more and more insulin resistance. So, you know, I think the main thing to take from that point is, number one, if you know you have that predisposition to have that type of body shape, first of all, get screened, okay? If you suddenly like put on weight that you didn't have before, go and get screened, because it's shown that if you had a sudden change in your body weight, your risk of becoming diabetic or pre-diabetic is higher. Go and get your screening test to make sure that is not you. If you know that you have diabetes in your family, and that I don't want to say a family where the shape is apples, we call them apples, apple-shaped bodies, go and get screened, because you likely genetically have insulin resistance in your family that could be affecting you as well. So I hope I answered your question as well as
definitely
I could.
You did. And right. You raise a very interesting point. So, do we have a caller, Grayson?
Yeah, well, I had one, but he didn't want to go on air. He preferred to employ me to do some scribing, so I tried my best to write it down. He's asking, how can you have a high blood sugar reading, I guess that's by the machine, and then very little sugar in the urine test? That's the litmus test. I don't know what test that is.
That's the urine test. So if you pass urine, you can check to see if you have sugar in it. Okay, so that's a wonderful question, and that's because how the kidney operates is when the blood goes, because the kidney is like the filtration organ in the body. So when you filter sugar, before it comes out, you can actually reabsorb it in the kidney. And people have different rates of filtration and reabsorption. So this is why the amount of sugar in your urine is not necessarily a good indicator of what your blood sugar is. There is going to be one person, say for example, their blood sugar might be 9 and they're spilling sugar. There's another person whose blood sugar might be 13 and they have no sugar. So this is why we actually kind of moved away from checking your urine to determine what your blood sugar is, because it's not a direct correlation between the two. So it's actually therefore better if you're going to check your blood sugar to check your blood sugar. Whereas in the past, where we didn't have as much access, people used to actually dip sticks in urine to go, okay, this is how much sugar you have. I remember a lady who had type 1 diabetes, she was 70 something and she was presenting. She lived in South America. And she said her mother had to try and manage her diabetes by checking her urine for sugar. And she was like, it was crazy. You know, so we have so much more technology now to help us. And this is why we don't rely primarily on the urine to tell you how high your sugar is. But if you do pick up sugar in your urine, you should go ahead and have, you know, the screening test. Likewise, sometimes there's some people who might spill a little sugar in the urine and they're not diabetic at all, right? So it's because our kidneys and our bodies behave differently.
All right. Thank you so kindly. Beg your pardon, Dr. Lewis. Just one thing of note here. One thing of note here. After that caller came through, the panel of lights decided to have a Christmas tree display, so it's just lighting up. That tells me something is wrong with the lines. So if they want to voice a question, they might have to do it via WhatsApp. So if you're calling via the telephone lines and not getting through, there might be a good reason for that. So just want to make you aware of that. All right? Go ahead, please.
Well, so let's just remind our listeners then of the WhatsApp number. That's 266-4862. So like Gregson said, if you're calling and for some reason you're not getting through, please feel free to send us that question or comment on WhatsApp. So Dr. Brathwaite, we're having a very interesting discussion so far. And there's something that you said that really made me think, because typically when we look at the symptoms of diabetes, people talk a lot about weight loss. They don't talk about, you know, if you gain weight, go and get yourself screened. Yeah, so that was actually quite insightful. But I wondered, what are some of the other symptoms of either insulin resistance or diabetes that one might want to consider?
Okay, I mean, so obviously if you put on weight, I would say for insulin resistance, if you notice, for example, say that you're getting, you have like dark marks around your neck or your arms, it's a big fancy word called acanthosis nigricans, and it's almost like a dark velvety rash that happens in the body folds. That is a sign of insulin resistance as well. In terms of signs and symptoms, you can get signs such as increasing thirst. For some people, there may be increasing hunger, so you feel like you're never satisfied, you're constantly ravenous. You can have things like passing urine more often, as was mentioned, weight loss, blurry vision, itchy skin, getting yeast infections more frequently. Some people may even get tingling in their fingers and their toes, etc. And even sexual dysfunction, male sexual dysfunction. But what I want to, and I always emphasize it, the most common sign is absolutely nothing. When you're having symptoms related to diabetes, your sugars are probably actually quite high and you've probably had diabetes for some time. So this is why we keep emphasizing that you must go and get screened for diabetes. You don't wait to get symptoms, because if you're waiting for symptoms, you might have had diabetes for the last 2 years. So we have to have a formula, maybe a discussion with your doctor. Do I need to get diabetes screening as part of my regular medical? The same way you go and you get your blood pressure check or your cholesterol, do I need to have my diabetes screened? And if I do need a screening, okay. And if it's negative, when do I need to repeat it? If I'm pre-diabetic, what do I do next? And when do I need to repeat it again? So these are really important conversations that we must have with our doctors. As you would know, Kia, before we used to say, get your diabetes screening as an adult when you're over the age of 45. That was then. Now the age is if you're over the age of 35. And under the age of 35, if you have some of the risk factors that we mentioned. Okay, now all of this is to accommodate the, I would say, reducing age at which we're seeing type 2 diabetes occurring. With type 1 diabetes, you're generally talking about somebody who's going to present because they're unwell, because type 1, the blood sugars actually climb relatively quickly. And people don't normally screen for type 1 unless, of course, for example, you're in a family and you have a sibling with type 1. We don't even do the screening here in Barbados, but there is genetic screening that can see, well, do I have markers for type 1 diabetes or screen for early? But we don't do that screening per se here. Most people with type 1, unfortunately, present with very high blood sugars and they're normally quite unwell. You said something that I thought was interesting, and this is just to highlight the point. You said most people don't think about screening if they put on weight, but if they're losing weight. If you're losing weight because of high blood sugars, you're in a state that you don't actually want to be in. You know, then if you're losing weight, your blood sugars are actually going to be very high, right? And you actually have possibly had diabetes, type 2 diabetes, I would say, for a while, or you may have type 1 that's kind of smoldering and waiting to kind of kick itself and land you in the hospital, right? So we don't want to wait for symptoms. If you have any, yes, go and screen, but make screening a part of your routine medical. Know when you're supposed to do it and how often you're supposed to repeat it. The other thing that I want to mention very quickly before we move off of this, people need to understand two things about diabetes. The easiest time to put your diabetes in remission or to reverse it is through an early diagnosis. That's why you want to pick it up before you have symptoms, if possible. Or at the time of diagnosis, you want to do everything you can do to reverse it. That when you've had diabetes 15 years, 20 years, it's not impossible. It is so much harder because there's so much that kind of goes on in your body. It doesn't mean that things can't improve. You might improve them quite substantially, but you may, for example, instead of being on 4 medications, you might need 1 medication. But it's always best if you can really home in on that when you first pick it up. And just smack it in the butt, get rid of it, and move on with your life. If it's pre-diabetes you've picked up, or type 2 diabetes, if you are able to, because not everybody's able to. And the other thing is, if you pick up anything the time of diagnosis, even if you can't get it reversed or in remission, because there's some people who that will not happen for, okay? But for a lot of type 2s, it can happen, but you have to make really clear and strong changes to your life and your lifestyle. It takes a lot of effort and a lot of commitment, but it can be done. Not easy, but it can be done. It just really takes a conscious effort and that decision to do that. But even if you have to be on medication, if you control your diabetes very well from diagnosis, and we discussed this at a meeting today, they have shown that 15 years down the road, your risk of complications are so much less compared to somebody who has not been well controlled in their first 5 to 7 years. Your complications are just so much less. You're going to end up on less medication. You may delay going on to insulin or something like that possibly. So what I'm saying is, get the early screening, find out what's going on, and do what you have to do either to get yourself into reversal remission or very tightly controlled from the get zero. And then the reality is that down the road, your trajectory looks a bit better than somebody who kind of just hangs around with it, doesn't quite fix it there, doesn't quite make the changes. The blood sugars are still high a year down the road. You're asking for trouble down the road if that is going to be, you know, if that's what's going to happen with your blood sugars.
Dr. Barfoot, you've shared so many gems with us just in that response. So much information. And I hope that persons who either have diabetes or are at risk are really taking in what you are saying about the importance of screening, early diagnosis, and early control of diabetes. So once you're diagnosed, not just throwing it in and say, oh, well, I have sugar anyway, so I might as well live my life. But really getting that under control early so that further down the line, you reduce the risk of all these complications. I want to talk a little bit more about screening. I just want to flip back to something really quick that you mentioned, and that's acanthosis nigricans. The reason why I'm flipping back here is because I've heard people say, you know, I sometimes you highlight it, you say, did you notice that the back of your neck is a little bit darker and the skin is rough? And I've heard people actually say to me, that's because she don't wash her neck properly. I don't know if you've ever heard that. She don't wash her neck properly. Literally, I've heard patients or other people say that to me, their family relatives. That's nothing. She just don't wash her neck properly. And I wanted to point out that what you're seeing behind there, guys, is not a buildup of dirt. Yes? This is this is something you need to take seriously. It is a sign of insulin resistance called acanthosis nigricans. It's actually more common than we would like to think. So if you haven't heard of it before, look it up. Go and see what it looks like on black skin. And if you see it in somebody that you love, please encourage them to be screened for diabetes. So I just wanted to highlight that.
All right, Doc, before you move on, I think I've got about 3 queries here for Dr. Brathwaite. Shall I go ahead, please?
Yes, sure.
The first one is, this might be an assumption, though. They say, a message for the doc. Why do doctors not use the HbA1c test more in Barbados?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, I use it all the time, but obviously I work in the area.
All right.
I think sometimes there challenges with availability, but really and truly, it should be relatively easy to get an A1C test. We offer it at our center, the Diabetes Center. The Diabetes and Hypertension Association also does diabetes screening. I know at some point in time, there was some challenge with some of the polyclinics having the kits to do it, but they certainly do have it now. But in terms of general private practices, they can take the blood and send it to the lab to do the screening. So it depends on where you're going. But I'll just say, for example, if anybody had a high suspicion and for some reason they didn't have access to kits, there's something called an oral glucose tolerance test that you can do. But I don't know, Kia, I guess I can't 100% relate to the comment because I guess I thought everybody uses it, but you don't use only the A1C. You can do the A1C, but we tend to do two tests. So we will tend to do a fasting blood sugar and an A1C as initial screening. If we need to, we'll do a confirmatory test with something called an oral glucose tolerance test if you need to, or if the diagnosis is in doubt for some reason. So I hope that answers the person's question, but I think as well, it goes back to making sure that your patients are screening properly as a part of their annual medical. They don't have to do it every year, but knowing when you have to screen and how often you have to screen. So maybe that might be it.
Dr. Brathwaite, I don't know if I can add. So just as a GP, I think I can't speak for everybody, but a lot of us, if not most of us, do A1Cs. We take blood and we send it to the lab to get the A1C done. Many GPs also have A1C machines in their office. So, like you said, it depends on where you go. But I think most doctors know. And this is why education is so important. If for some reason you have not been offered an A1C, definitely bring it up with your doctor because it's widely available at every lab you can think about on the island. But yeah, if there's some reason you've not been offered an A1C, bring it up and have a discussion with your doctor as to why you might not have been offered an A1C. Some doctors will do a fasting blood sugar and not go on to do the A1C, which in some circumstances might be fine. So that's what I would add from a GP perspective.
Okay.
I definitely include it in my annual medical packages.
All right. This other person has two queries. First one is, what can be done with a belly that is getting big because of the diabetes? How to reduce my measurement? That's the first query. So that question is, what can be done with a belly that is getting big because of the diabetes? How to reduce my measurement? That's number one. And the second one is, how can I normalize my morning reading if I eat before 7:30, or if I don't eat at all, the reading in the morning is high, between 168 to 178. What must I do? Those are the two queries.
Okay, In terms of reducing the belly part, that's really going to come down to some serious lifestyle modification. Now, I want to tell that person, you may not be a Coke bottle when you're 16 ever again. And that's a reality. I'm trying to get the Coke bottle and I can't find the Coke bottle anywhere on me anymore. But even if you lose an inch, two or three off of that abdomen, it's going to make a huge difference to your blood sugars. So that's number one. Number two, you have to look at, and so that's going to be with a combination of diet and exercise. Diet is actually really, really important. And when you're looking at the diet, you really want to do an overall calorie reduction. People do this in different ways. Some people will have reduced the calories and look at portion control throughout the day. Some people, I'm going to put it out here because people are doing it, so I don't want to pretend people aren't doing it. Some people go on to diets. The challenge with diets for most people is that people treat diets as short-term things. So I do this, I might get a low result, then I go back to normal eating. So of course you put back on the weight. Some people do slightly lower carbohydrate diets. There has been a trend with something called, ketosis diet. For me personally, I tried it in ketogenic diet. I tried it and nearly killed me. But then I don't eat a lot. I don't eat meat or anything. So it was very hard for me. At the time I was eating fish, it was extremely hard for me to do. I couldn't do it. And then there's also intermittent fasting. So there is evidence for intermittent fasting out there as a form of a diet/lifestyle that can help you reduce weight. But what people have to understand, it's fine to say I'm doing intermittent fasting, which means that I'm eating for shorter periods in the day. It does not suit everybody. It can suit some people. It depends on what else is going on with you, what medications you're using. But if you're eating the same amount of calories in in 8 hours that you're eating in 14 hours, you're not going to lose any weight, right? So weight loss has to do with calorie reduction, of course, okay? And then, of course, you mentioned, you know, the physical activity. The second question, I would love to remember what it was, but it's just gone out my brain. So you're going to have to remind me, Kia.
Yeah, let me help you.
Greg, the second.
Yeah, the second one was, how can I normalize my morning reading to be normal? If I eat before 7:30 or if I don't eat at all, the reading in the morning is high, between 168 to 178. What must I do?
So that is a high fasting. So I want to just explain the term very quickly. There's something in type 2 diabetes, it's called the dawn phenomena. And what it is in the morning, usually anywhere between 4 o'clock and 8 o'clock in the morning, we have other hormones floating about in our body. And one of those hormones is called cortisol. And it actually makes you start to break down your own body liver stores of starches and produce your own body sugar. So there are a number of people who have type 2 diabetes who will find that, actually, why is my fasting blood sugar always higher than my daytime readings? Or why is it high when I went to bed with a sugar that was okay? But what I would say for that person, sometimes that may be the cause, okay? It depends on what medication you're taking. I don't want to get too complex because that's actually a huge kind of question. But you also want to look at what are you eating, you know, at night? What is your blood sugar before you have that last meal? What is it after? Sometimes people don't realize some of the simple things that will actually raise their blood sugar before they go to bed, like eating grapes before you go to bed, or having a hot chocolate or Ovaltine or whatever. There are a lot of things that we do that we think, this is great, this is healthy. And while it might not be the worst thing in the world, it might not work for you with somebody with diabetes. So for that person, what I would say is they actually need to discuss it with their doctor. They need to do what we call some very blood sugar tests and take it with some food information to find out exactly why their sugars are basically nearly 9 to 10 every morning, because that is actually high. If the person is on medication, it might be an imbalance in the medication. In other words, the medication might not be completely correctly titrated for their body, because everybody has a different, especially if you're taking insulin, your requirements are very different. Sometimes you have to balance things out differently. Sometimes if you're taking an insulin, it might be the insulin that you're using at night might not be the right dose, or it might not be the right combination of insulin for you. So as I said, that was actually a loaded question, and that's something that they need to discuss with their doctor to find out exactly why it's happening. And we normally have ways that we kind of, things that we normally tell people to do and check, and certain pieces of advice, find out exactly what it is, rule out anything that might be causing it. And if you're dealing with a dawn phenomena, then you look at how you can address that. So I don't want to go on more because it's actually a complicated question, but they should discuss it with their healthcare provider.
All right. I've got a couple.
Arthur, just as a follow-on, though, you mentioned something. You talked about numbers, right? Because you're talking about how that number is very high. I don't want us to close the program without you telling us what those numbers should be. So we talked about screening. We know we should be screening over the age of 35 and less than that if you have risk factors. We talked about the methods of screening, the HbA1c, fasting, blood sugar, and then the oral glucose tolerance test in certain circumstances. We talked about how often we should screen. Yeah, I think we had mentioned annually for most people at risk.
Depends on what guidelines you're following.
Right. So it's between the guidelines.
Every 2 years, 2 years or so. So it depends on the situation. But once again, that's something you decide with between yourself, you know, and your healthcare provider.
Mm-hmm. Right. But then we need to make sense of the numbers. So for persons who might be checking their blood sugars at home, what do those numbers look like? If what is the number at which you would diagnose you with diabetes? For those who are already diagnosed with diabetes, what would an appropriate fasting blood sugar be like, for example? Let's talk numbers.
Okay, so that person mentioned there are numbers in the hundreds. So that's a reading, and we call it milligrams per deciliter. That is a unit that's commonly used in America. More commonly here in Barbados, we use millimoles per liter, which is more like, you know, single or double digits, basically. It doesn't go into the hundreds. Or isn't over 72 or anything like that. So in terms of diagnosis, you're looking at a fasting blood sugar that is 5.7 or more. And if it is in the middle of the day at any point in time, 11.1. So if you pick up any of these things, you really should go to your doctor and ask your doctor, well, can you kindly test me? If your blood sugar is over 7 points, it's either 7.6, 7.8 in the middle of the day. So if you're getting anything above 7.8 in the middle of the day, still go and get screened, because remember, you're now, you might be slightly elevated, falling into the pre-diabetes zone, but not quite the diabetes zone. Okay. And the numbers can vary greatly depending on what you ate, what you didn't eat. So, you know, you need to really have a proper screen, I think, to establish the diagnosis. Just, and this is why I keep emphasizing, you cannot check a blood sugar at one point in time and say, I have or I do not have diabetes, because if you depend on that, you're going to be severely misled. Okay, the sugars are always changing. In terms of if you have diabetes, well, first of all, what we say about having diabetes and control is that your targets for your blood sugar really should be individualized, meaning that you come to a consensus of what your number should be for your body. So, for example, Kia, the numbers are the control that I would recommend to you. I would not necessarily recommend to an older person who's 80 living on their own. I might not recommend to somebody who's having low blood sugars and slips between high and low very easily. But I'm going to just give a general range. So we like the fasting blood sugar to be, so say for younger persons like yourself, Kia, we want you to be between 4 and 6. Somebody else who's a little bit older may say, okay, actually, we'll accept once it's under 7. So say 5, 6s, and 7s, because there's some people out there who do not tolerate a blood sugar of 4 very well at all. They just feel like they're going to drop down every time they get a 4. But technically speaking, we always say under 4 is considered a low blood sugar. Now, 2 hours after you eat food, we try to keep those blood sugars under 8, so 5, 6, 7s max, okay? An older person or somebody who has what we call more brittle diabetes, we may let it go up to 10. These are pretty hard targets. Some of the guidelines will say under 10 is normal, but for me personally, when I'm practicing, I don't want my patients at 9 and 10. That's a no-no for me. For me, under 8, you keep your blood sugars, say, between 4.5 and to the 7s, and I'm happy with that, okay? And the reason for that is because we know that good control and not having your blood sugars flying up and down, that's what prevents complications. And I personally am not of the view, because you have diabetes, your blood sugars are supposed to be higher than mine, right? The idea is that you're supposed to have normal blood sugar control, right? So unfortunately, some people get used to this idea, oh, I have diabetes, so man, I got 7, I got 8, I got 11. My good man, it's not good, you know? And so thanks for bringing up that question. And that's why people, you know, you need to know what your targets are. But once again, discuss it with your healthcare provider so you have targets that are relatively safe for you. Now, one thing that I want to say, and I don't know if anybody might slush me down for saying this, I'm going to be honest, life happens. People do things. You might decide here you're going to a wedding and you're going to have a little bit more. So if you have that rare occasion or that odd occasion where you have a treat and your blood sugar went up to 11, it is not the end of the world. You come back and you do what you do on a day-to-day basis properly. However, you cannot have those treats and those spikes on a daily basis and not, you know, and think, well, I'm never going to have any issues related to diabetes, you know. So life does have to be a bit more regimented. When you have diabetes, you should have a basic healthy way of eating every single day. Minimize all of these sugary beverages that we're taking. There's a lot of extra sugar and calories that we really don't need. And, you know, cut down the fat in the diet. We already mentioned the issue with the fats and how the excessive fats actually deposit in your liver and make you more insulin resistant. As one of my friends says, and she's not a doctor, but she believes in eating real. She says, eat real food. Okay, eat more real foods, not all the food that comes out of cans and boxes.
Packages. Yep.
That's 10 times over. It has 50 ingredients and you don't know what any of them are. Try to eat more real food. Learn about portion control. I think you said you wanted to do something that, so I won't go into that. A lot of us eat portions that are way bigger than what we should be eating, including children, right? So for a lot of people, even if you just go back to simple portion control and cutting out all the sugary beverages, you will automatically lose weight because you're cutting your calories, you know, immediately. And we even see that at the diabetes center. We fix diets and we have people who lose 10, 15, 20 pounds, right? Just by changing the diet. Sometimes instead of having to add medication, we get to take away medication. You know, but you must do it in conjunction with the healthcare provider, as I said, because not everybody is the same. And you must do it and know the sugars at the same time. Some people use the thing, I'm exercising, I'm going to lose weight so I can stop taking medication. No. Have a discussion and make sure your sugars are always controlled. And if there's a gradual reduction that your doctor's advising, then you kind of come down gradually, but with their advice and based on the blood sugars. Okay, don't do it blindly on your own, because you may feel well, but you might not realize, actually, well, I cut that down, I'm exercising, I feel good, whatever. But sometimes in the day, your blood sugars are going up to 11, 12, 13, and 14. Yeah, and you're not
monitoring, you don't know. Absolutely. Very, very good advice. Gregson, I know you had another question.
Yeah, time is getting away from us, but I've got three. I don't know if we can have some quick responses here. Can I go? Go ahead.
Yeah, sure. Yes.
Yeah.
We have a few more minutes.
All right. This one says...
sentence, go.
This one says, so there is a difference between fasting blood sugar test and the HbA1c test. Is one more effective than the other in determining a person's diabetic status? That's number one.
Excellent question, Dr. Barfitt. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so number one, they're completely different. The HbA1c is a percentage measure. People say it kind of estimates how much sugar has been floating around in the body over a period of about 3 months maximum. Fasting blood sugar is the blood sugar at the point in time, and it is a completely different number. The two of them do not correlate. The best way in terms of diagnosis is actually combining the two tests together and then doing further tests if you need to. Next question.
Excellent.
Okay, this one says, can a patient have a normal blood sugar but an elevated HbA1c? Different person asking that question. And the last part of that question is, can that person then be considered a diabetic?
Yes, absolutely. They can be. Remember, I said the blood sugar is just what it is at that point in time. The A1C is summing up the average. So say, for example, I could have a 4.3, then I could have an 8, then I could have a 9, then I can have a 10. You can't depend on your blood sugar at one point in time to tell you whether you have prediabetes or diabetes. Full stop.
All right. And the final one. Would you recommend Victoza to control diabetes and lose weight?
Do I recommend Victoza for what?
Would you recommend Victoza to control diabetes and lose weight?
Yeah, Victoza certainly can be used in some people. It's used a lot more overseas. There are a whole class of medications. They're called GLP-1 agonists. They're what we call injectable non-insulins. Our challenge here is simply that they're very, very expensive medications. So the average person might not be able to afford it. We have Byetta, we have Victoza, and there is some Ozempic floating around in Barbados. But as I said, they're actually quite expensive, so not necessarily within the pocket of everybody. Now, we will recommend it certainly for some patients. I do have some patients who are on them, but once again, because it is not a drug service medication, you have to pay for it, and you can be talking anywhere between $200+ a month up to about $1,100 a month for those types of medications.
Okay, thank you. Those are the queries. Back to you, Dr. Lewis.
Thank you so much. Dr. Bradford, we didn't get to go into medical management, but if you could tell the listeners very quickly, what are some of the screenings, persons with diabetes, who are some of the other physicians that they might want to see annually, or the other medical care providers that they might want to see every year to have the appropriate screening done?
Okay, when you say providers, you mean persons, specialties, or services?
Specialties, services, yeah.
Okay, so first of all, so remembering that diabetes management, you have to approach it from different angles. So you're going to have your healthcare provider. You do need education. So you may need to see a general educator, or if you're on more complex medication regimens or insulin, or you have type 1 diabetes, you really should be working with a diabetes specialist nurse who's trained in those areas. Of course, you have your nutritionist or your dietitian. Of course, you should be getting your eyes checked and screened on an annual basis. If you need it more often than that, the person will recommend that to you. Okay, an annual screening test, and that kidney test, and that can be done by anybody. Always pointing out with the kidneys, you need to do urine protein estimations, microalbumin, and also the blood kidney test, and that's called your serum creatinine. The urine proteins are very important because your proteins go up long before your blood kidney test goes up. Okay, we're also going to put into that mix there, don't forget, you have to check your blood pressure, have your blood pressure control. Check your cholesterol, have your cholesterol controlled. Diabetes works hand in hand with hypertension. If you have both and your blood pressure is not controlled, but your diabetes is controlled, you're still going to mash up your kidneys from the blood pressure. So you have to look at managing basically the whole of you. Your foot checks, you should be doing your own foot checks on a daily basis, checking the bottom of your foot. If you can't see the bottom of your foot, have somebody check your foot, check your nails, okay? If you can't see it, can't do it, or you have complications, or you have numbness, or somebody said, wait, you have poor circulation, maybe you should be seeing a healthcare provider or a podiatrist with your feet. So the list really can go on. I want one other thing that I didn't point out there is mental health. Right? There are a lot of people who are struggling with things like their mood, their mental health, social things, and then still trying to manage diabetes. It's hard to managing diabetes on its own. That is hard enough. That's work enough. So make sure that if you're having a challenge that you get whatever help you need, whether it may be from a counselor, it might be from a church counselor, maybe a friend that you can trust and talk to about things. You don't keep everything inside you when you're sitting down there stewing and stressing. First of all, it's making your blood sugar higher. And number one, you don't have any energy left now to give to managing diabetes. Okay? Psychologists, there are nurses that are attached to all the polyclinics who do counseling as well, who have psychiatry and psychology training backgrounds. So don't ignore the mental health aspect of it. I hope I answered your question.
That's exactly what I wanted. Dr. Barker, yeah. We are over time, but I want to give you 30 seconds. If you could say anything to the public of Barbados about diabetes in wrapping up, what would your take-home message be?
I would say diabetes is a serious medical condition. There's a lot of stigma that's associated with it. We have come to the point where people assume because you have diabetes, well, I'm automatically going to end up with this, that, or the next complication. So let's just dish out all of that past nonsense. And what I would say is you do not have to become a statistics, but you have to change what you're doing. You have to get educated. You have to get diagnosed with diabetes and pre-diabetes very early. And you have to do everything right from the beginning. You can have a perfectly normal, long life, but you must take care of yourself and you must get educated and you must screen yourself regularly. My last sentence is, in Barbados, let's set our children up for a better future. Right now, we're not setting them up for a better future because the numbers are not going that way. But we need to support things like the food health policy. We need to take some of that information and bring it into our homes. We need to practice what we preach and be an example for our children. If you want to secure the health of your child, you have to start doing it from the time they're small. Give them good patterns. Don't set them up for diabetes and all the other complications down the road. More often than not, unknowingly, but find out what should I be doing for my child to secure their health so they don't go there. My last phrase, we know that right now in Barbados, what's happening, we are seeing 20, 30, and 40-year-olds with diseases. When I was 30 years ago as a medical student, we used to see in people who were 60 and 70. We are seeing these in very young adults now. And we have to do something to shift that pattern, or it's just going to continue in the next generation and in our children.
Thank you so much, Dr. Barker. Very wise words indeed. And this has been an incredible program in terms of the information, just the flow of ideas. So I just want to say, and thank you to our callers and those who message in as well. Excellent questions. We are so grateful. So I just want to encourage you to take this information with you. Don't just let it fall on the wayside. Take it seriously, apply it, share it with somebody. And as always, I wish you a blessed week. Take good care of yourself. You know, try your best. You won't always be perfect, but try your best to take good care of your health. So that's wishing you goodbye again for another Better Health program, and we look forward to having you join us again next week.
All right. Thank you so much kindly. That's Dr. Keir Lewis, and a big thank you to Dr. Diane Brathwaite, her guest this evening. Like Dr. Lewis said, no stranger to the Better Health Radio Show. I'm quite sure you'll be back at some point in time. Always welcome. Thank you, and take care of yourselves, and have a wonderful,
Bye.
Wonderful work week ahead, and until we hear each other again on the Better Health Radio Show. Thank you, ladies. Take care.